Now, I'm very grateful to the organisers for letting me talk about this nonsense. I feel a little bit embarrassed being here and listening to so many of the great leaps forward that have come about in CSP through the algebraic method, where I'm talking about something that is essentially quite an asinine problem. But even though it's quite a silly problem, I hope to suggest that it's reasonably well motivated, and even beyond that, it has quite an elegant theory, an elegant classification. So this was a project I started 3 years ago, purely combinatorially, and quickly we realized there was some kind of algebraic possibilities, and I started working with Florent Madeleine, and then we derived some results, some classifications. And then at some point, we could go no further unless we had a computer that could search through the lattice. Not the entire lattice, but a finite lattice, just the bottom of a finite lattice. And so I enlisted the help of my brother, who is moonlighting. He's not an academic, he's in industry. So, yes, I'll continue to talk about this strange problem, first-order logic without equality. So, first of all, we consider the model-checking problem. Now, this in itself is something that causes trouble in computer science, because model-checking problem has a very specific definition in computer science. Normally, I couldn't tell you exactly what the definition is, because I'm a bad computer scientist, but it has to do with verification. And normally, one fixes a sentence in a logic, and then the input is some structure. So the problem is defined by a class of potential structures, and some of them the sentence is true on, and some of them are not. But there's no reason why it can't be given in this general framework. The model checking problem essentially takes a sentence and a structure and asks whether the sentence is true on the structure. So in our case, we're going to consider a logic, and we'll fix the structure, and the problem has input a sentence phi of the logic, and is it true on the fixed structure. And we consider what I call syntactic fragments of first order logic, and structures that are relational and finite. I feel bad because I work a lot with the speakers earlier in the day, and they talk about infinite CSPs, and now I come here and only talk about the finite case. So I also apologize, by the way, if anyone was at the LIX workshop, because my co-author, Florent, he gave a talk there that has many of the similar slides, because his slides are in fact very good. And he created this monstrous table, which is better than the alternative which I had, which is maybe 6 or 7 slides. So we start off with the syntax of first order logic. And first order logic involves two quantifiers, two binary connectors, negation, and I'm going to take equality and disequality somehow as primitive. There are many fragments of first-order logic that one can give syntactically, but for the purpose of this talk, when I say syntactic fragment, I mean restricting to a certain number of these quantifiers and connectors. And it's got to be a non-trivial fragment, and therefore we would ask that it has at least one of the quantifiers, at least one of the binary connectors. Of course, there are other ways to give syntactic restrictions, like Horn logic and such like, but for the moment, we just consider these. So some of these fragments are very simple. For example, if we have just exists and or, we can easily check that on a fixed structure by looking at each of the atoms in the disjunction and seeing whether any of them can be satisfied. And this is just searching through the tuples. This is also true if we have equality or disequality. It's still in log space. This is a very simple algorithm. And always we're talking about duality up there. So in some sense, well, in the natural De Morgan sense, for all and is dual to exist and or. So we have a sentence like this, a graph sentence. A models exist, V1, V2, V3, and there's an edge between V1 and V2, and an edge between V2 and V3. Then this is the same as A not modeling for all V1, V2, V3, not not an edge, V1, V2, or not an edge, V2, V3. And so if we consider the complement structure of A, that is where we take the same signature, but we take the complements of all the relations, then we have something like this going on. And we have a Turing reduction between the problems. And this is essentially what I'm saying here, that we have primitive positive logic, exists an AND, or exists AND and equals. We can propagate out equality. And this is somehow equivalent to the situation that we have when we have for all and disjunction, or for all and disjunction and not equals. A classification for one would yield a classification for the other. If we would have a P or NP complete classification there, then we would have a P or co-NP complete classification there. So there's an obvious duality. So I've passed over this middle collection. This is exists AND and OR. In fact, there is a dichotomy there, but it's a trivial dichotomy. Your log space, if there is some element A such that all relations are A valid, that is such that all relations have the tuple, the self-loop at A, tuple of all A's, and we're NP complete otherwise. The CSP situation is well known, so there are four fragments essentially that give rise to CSP. This is something that's similar to CSP, but if we have exists and not equals, then it's easy to see that we're NP complete as soon as the domain becomes of size 3 or more, because we have three colouring there, the K3 three colouring. And for the domain size 2, we just reduce to Schaefer cases. We can look that up according to Schaefer's classification. And this follows, of course, also for the dual fragment. Here we have something else. So this is the two quantifiers and conjunction, or equivalently the two quantifiers and disjunction. And we have the quantifier constraint satisfaction problem. Now, there isn't a formal classification conjectured here, but I think it's not unreasonable that we might conjecture a trichotomy here. That maybe should read trichotomy. P NP completes or P space completes. Certainly no other complexities are known. Again, here we have QCSP, but with always hard P space complete on domain sizes 3. Otherwise, we have the Schaefer cases. And down here, we have again a number of trivial cases. There are, of course, very few fragments here that have negation, because when you have negation and exists, then you have for all by De Morgan negation, and then you have all. And so the purpose of this slide is simply to explain that, in some sense, there are only three interesting cases here. CSP we well know, QCSP we know reasonably well, and this third one, which is a very strange logic. It's positive equality free logic. Exists and exists for all and an or, but no equality. The reason we forbid equality is because if we have equality, then we have this trivial classification. We're log space when the domain is of size 1 and P space complete otherwise. But for this logic here, there is some richness again in the classification. And when we started out looking at it, the idea was that it wouldn't be too difficult and it wouldn't be too easy. And then, you know, when you solve it, you think maybe could it have been a bit harder, and then it would be more, you know, more worthwhile, but that wasn't to be. So what I present here is a tetrachotomy for this model checking problem. And the ingredients are a Galois correspondence, similar to the INS-POL correspondence for CSP, similar to the INS-S-POL surjective polymorphism correspondence for QCSP. And tractability via relativization of quantifiers. The reason tractability is in inverted commas there, in speech marks, is because by tractability I mean a collapse from p-space completeness. So in some sense, N being membership of NP, membership of tel-NP is tractability. Then membership of log space is the ultimate form of tractability. And then once you've got a general idea of why things are easy by elimination of quantifiers, then you can prove that certain templates realize the hardness, and then you have your hardness proofs. So Ferdinand Berner gave a general recipe book for Galois connections, and this is something he presented at Dougstuhl, I think in 2006. I wasn't there, but I saw a copy of his talk and his notes. And so let me explain a little bit. The Galois connection in general has... Okay, we should start off by assuming that we always have exists. Once we have exists, then we're always mapping something somewhere. We're mapping something to some non-empty set. If we don't have exists, then we have partial functions. But we're always going to have exists, so we always have some kind of function. If we have equality, we have real functions. If we have no equality, we have hyperfunctions, so we map elements to non-empty sets. When we have the universal quantifier, we have a kind of surjectivity. When we have disjunction, we have unarity. When we have disequality, we have injectivity. If we have atomic negation, we have full. This is a strong homomorphism, an if and only if, instead of just one direction. So we can read off from this classification what we have for primitive positive logic. We have exists, we have and, he's given and as being primitive as well. We have exists and we have equals. So we have functions, they're total, but they're not unary. So that's why we have Kary things that are Kary operations, things that become polymorphisms. For this logic, we need to consider surjective hyperendomorphisms, surjective hyperoperations. The weird thing also is that Ferdinand himself had studied a lot of these Galois connections, and the one I present today is essentially the only one he didn't study. He was studying a lot hyperoperations. He was studying clones of hyperclones, for example. So in the relational side, hyperclones are not so interesting because they give exists and without equality. But exists and without equality is basically the same as exists and with equality. So from CSP, you would make it harder for yourself if you were to study hyperclones. But from the algebraic side, they make perfect sense. And he was studying them. And one of the only things he wasn't studying were these things, these surjective hyperoperations, things that become surjective hyperendomorphisms. And so this is what we're considering. A surjective hyperoperation on a set maps an element to a set of elements, a non-empty set of elements. So it satisfies totality, it maps to a non-empty set, and it satisfies surjectivity, that every element of the domain must appear on the right-hand side. So let's consider that the domain is 1, 2, 3, the numbers 1, 2, 3. Then this is something like a surjective hyperoperation. I map 1 to 1, 2, 3, 2 to 3, and 3 to 2. It's total and it's surjective. 1 appears there, 2 appears there, 3 appears there. From the point of view of myself, I always draw these things like that. My brother, when he was computing on them, he prefers to see them as Boolean matrices, in which case the Boolean matrix here. And then, in that case, totality is having a 1 in every row, surjectivity is having a 1 in every column. Finally, there is another way to consider them. One can consider them as digraphs without sources or sinks. So the totality and surjectivity mean that there's no source and no sink. So in this case, 1 maps to 1, 1 maps to 2, 2 maps to 3. So these are three ways to consider shops. And a shop is a surjective hyperendomorphism if it preserves all extensional relations. So when you have a relation tuple in the structure, then look at all possible places in the image and ask that the relation be there. I must say we've not received universal acclaim for this notation, shop and she, but I think it's easier than saying surjective hyperoperation every time. I don't know really if there would be a better one. Maybe she is not the best thing. We had one guy say that, well, what's the difference between a he and a she? And it's surjectivity. So if we take this digraph here, then this is a shop here, and in fact it preserves this digraph, and so it's a surjective hyperendomorphism of the digraph. and why does it preserve it? So this is an animation that my co-author has produced for me, which I'm very glad to have. So we have the H1-2 there, and if we look at 1-2 in the shop, we must have both 1-1 and 1-2, and in fact, yep, we have 1-2 of course, but we also have 1-1. So we can check this for all edges in the digraph, and we'll find, sure enough, that it is preserved. So that shop is a she of that digraph. On the other hand, this shop is not. We have 1-2 there, but we would if it were to be a she, we would have to have 2-2, but we don't. This is actually one of the reasons why I don't like to consider the digraph version of a shop, because a shop does not necessarily preserve its own digraph representation. For example, we have 1-2 there, but we don't have 3-3. I draw the digraph representation because it will make a cameo later in the talk. So we can look at a digraph and consider its set of all of its surjective hyperendomorphisms. And in this case, we see that it has four. And these form a monoid. This is a generation. This is notation for generation. In some sense, which I'll make more precise, this single shop generates the entire monoid. The composition is the natural composition. If one goes to two and in another one two goes to three, then one would go to three. It's equivalent to matrix multiplication here. Or paths here. It's the natural composition. So it forms a monoid. Which I'm going to denote like this. So if that's the structure D, then the monoid of shops is written like this, she D. So a set of shops forms a particular type of monoid, which I'm going to call a down shop monoid. The down is for down closure, which is a notation that Ferdinand used. And this thing, it contains the identity, it's the very least you expect of a monoid, and it's closed under composition and these things subshop. So the composition is something we would expect, but so the identity shop, we know exactly what it is. We map everything to itself, the set itself. Composition, yes, this is a formal definition, but it's the natural notion of composition. And subshops, yeah, at every point we can take a subset. Of course, we have to remain surjective. So, for example, here, this is a subshop of that. I've just wiped out two, but it remains surjective. So one can take the matrix and turn ones to zeros, so long as you keep the condition that there is a one in every row and a one in every column. And we write the closure of F for the monoid generated by a set of surjective hyperoperations. And so here we have a Galois correspondence. So for a finite structure and a set of shops, the following holds. We have, this is the set of relations that can be defined on D in positive equality-free logic. And they are equivalent to the set of relations that are invariant under the surjective hyperendomorphisms of D. And that is one side of a Galois connection. The other side is that the monoid generated by F is equal to the set of surjective hyperendomorphisms of the invariants of F. The invariants of F one can consider as a structure over an infinite signature. This is obviously very similar to the inv-pol connection and the clone operation, or even the invs-pol connection and clones restricted to their surjective terms. It might be interesting to note, just because we did have the talks about the infinite earlier, that this would extend naturally to the omega categorical infinite case. The weird thing about these Galois connections is they don't have uniform proofs. The proof of one Galois connection doesn't always look like the proof of another one. And when you extend to the omega categorical case, while you have, as we had in the talks this morning, that inv pol equals pp in the omega categorical pet case, and in this case we'll have inv xi equals this positive equality-free logic. We don't know this, for example, in the world of QCSP. We don't know that inv of the surjective polymorphisms this is conjunctive logic, both quantified as conjunctive logic, sometimes called positive horn. And that's a theme that is going to recur a little bit. This class, positive equality-free logic, it enjoys some of the nice properties that were enjoyed by CSP. In fact, it enjoys many more nice properties. It's highly symmetric, whereas CSP isn't. And QCSP, between the two of them, often doesn't have these nice properties. In this case, we don't know that it doesn't have the nice property, we just can't prove it. But back to the finites. So we have this Galois connection, and we have its consequence, which is very similar to the situation for CSP, or QCSP, of course. If we take two finite structures that have the same domain, then when we have inclusion of their sets of surjective hyperendomorphisms, we have a reduction from one problem to another. We can say this reduction is log space or something. It's easy to say it's polynomial. For log space, we need the great results of Rheingold. And the motto here is, just like in the world of CSP, the polymorphisms control the expressive power and complexity. Here it's the surjective hyperendomorphisms that control the expressive power and complexity. Now these are the special shops. So when you fix two elements in the domain C and D, then there are these three special classes of shops: the A shops, the E shops, and the for all exist shops. Blue, red, and green. The colours are going to recur in the rest of the talk. So the A shop has the condition that at some point it maps an element to the entire domain. This is equivalent to its matrix having a row of ones somewhere. The E shop does the dual thing. It maps what there is an element that appears everywhere in the right hand side. This is equivalent to the shop having a column of ones. It's the dual. And so it has the property that the image of C is D, and this has the property that the inverse image is D. I haven't defined inverse because it's not necessary for the talk, but shops have the property that their natural inverse is also a shop, because the inverse condition of totality is surjectivity, and the inverse condition of surjectivity is totality. The reason I didn't define inverse is because we do not close the monoids under inverse. If we close the monoids under inverse, the whole problem becomes very simple to deal with. Well, quite simple to deal with. But there is this notion of inverse, and it makes sense, and it's still a shop. And for all exists here does the two things together. It, in fact, something has a for all exists shop if and only if it has both an A shop and an E shop. You can combine an A shop and an E shop under composition to get this green thing. And this is the reason why we're interested in these three classes of shop, because when we have a structure that has an A shop, then the complexity of the corresponding model checking problem collapses to NP, essentially because we can evaluate all universal variables to C. It's not quite as simple as that. You evaluate all universal variables to C, and you relativize the existential variables to a certain subset. The dual case is with the E shop and co-NP, and we can evaluate all existential variables to D, and relativize the universal variables to some suitable subset. And in the third case, the green case, we're in log space because we do both together. And in fact, these special surjective hyperoperations characterize fully the complexity. So if, for example, the relational structure is preserved by an A shop but no A for all exists shop, then the problem is in NP and is in fact NP complete because it doesn't drop further. And so this is something that we conjectured a year and a half ago or something. And note that it's already very different from the situation that we're in now with CSP. So here, We know the condition of easiness, the drops of complexity to NP, co-NP, and log space. What was left to do is to fill in the conditions for hardness, whereas in fact the opposite seems to be true if we believe the CSP dichotomy conjecture. We know the condition for hardness, and in fact the problem is fleshing out and filling in the cases that are tractable. So in some of the easiest cases, we have something like this. So it's quite difficult to see on the projector. The way I've marked up these shops, I'm dropping the curly brackets and the commas between the elements because they're not they're getting in the way. And so the lattice on a domain of size 2, when D is a two-element domain, 0 and 1, looks like this. It has 5 elements. The fact that we have this down closure makes it a lot simpler. One thing that you should notice, of course, with this lattice is that always sitting within it is the lattice of subgroups of S2. So when we have domain K and we look at the lattice, sitting within that is the symmetric group SK and its subgroups. Always the bottom element in the lattice is just the identity group. The identity shop is the identity permutation. And at the top we have all shops. Somewhere in the middle we have the full symmetric group. In this case, the parts that are coloured black correspond to where the problem is p-space complete, and the parts that are coloured green correspond to where the problem is in log space. So here we have a dichotomy that is similar to we have dichotomies, of course, for CSP and for QCSP on Boolean domains. The lattice is considerably richer in the three-element case, and we already jump up a little bit in richness because we have a tetrachotomy. We have 4 complexity classes showing the green, the blue, the red, and the black. Now, this is the lattice that appears in the three-element case, and this is an interesting thing because I claim that the shops, particularly these monoids, because of their down closure, they enjoy many benign properties that make them a bit like permutations. But you can see that they are not that like permutations, that the lattice of subgroups of the symmetric group S3 contains 6 members. And already here we're at 120 or something. My brother computed the lattice. The classification doesn't rely on this. You can see that almost all of the lattice is green. So it's not too difficult to follow. Again, at the bottom we have the identity shop. At the top we have all shops, and then we have this sort of mess in the middle. It's very interesting because this lattice is highly symmetric, but the graph program that draws it is not able to see that because it has so many elements. It would be interesting to see if we have a graph drawing package when computers are more powerful, or better graph drawing packages in 10, 20, 30 years, whether they will be able to see the symmetry in this lattice and draw it in a different fashion. This is in fact the part of the lattice that appeared in the original paper. It's the only part that matters, and it's drawn here in a cruciform arrangement, rather Masonic. And this is the identity here. It was at the bottom of the old lattice. And in fact, this is the bottom of the lattice because it contains all of the p-space complete cases, the black cases, all of the red co-NP complete, all of the blue NP complete, and it contains only the minimal log space cases, and then everything above this is green. And here is the theorem that we have this tetrachotomy according to what's going on in this lattice. And somehow the important thing, this is the same of course for CSP and for QCSP, when you want hardness proofs, you go to the maximal things that hold that complexity. So if we can prove p-space completeness for these, then it follows that everything below them is also p-space complete. So always for hardness proofs, we're looking at the maximal monoids that are p-space complete, that are co-NP complete, that are NP complete. And if we look at these, we zoom in on these at the bottom of the lattice, we see something interesting. So this monoid is S3. And what about these monoids? Well, if you squint at them, if you look at them and squeeze your eyes, you can see that 1 and 2 are somehow exactly the same. And so if you make 1 and 2 the same element, then this is just the copy of S2. And so is this just a copy of S2. And so is this just a copy of S2. And maybe it's a good time to point out now that the model checking problem for S2 and the model checking problem for S3, so canonical templates for K2 and K3, they're in fact p-space complete. We know for this that already its QCSP is p-space complete, but I should mention that although the QCSP of K2 is in P, its model checking problem here is p-space complete because already we have disjunction, so we can define quantified not all equal 3 SAS. So S2 is hard, S3 is hard, and the templates that witness this are K3 and K2. In fact, the template that witnesses this thing looks a bit more like this. It's something like that, so. And I've forgotten, so the one on the left, it's 1 and 2 that are together. You can imagine that a logic without equality can't tell the difference between that structure and that structure, because those two things look exactly the same. So in the four-element case, there are 20 maximal p-space complete monoids, and we were able to isolate them by a computer search. The computer, in fact, tested an inductive hypothesis, and it was able to do it. So over here we have S4. This is a copy of S3, and these two things are both copies of S2. But over here we have something completely new that is not in any way group-like. And this is in fact why the four-element case is different from the three-element case. Something new is happening. The three-element case was just throwing up things that are quite group-like, but now we're throwing up things that are actually of a different flavor from groups. And at some point I was trying, maybe we thought we could do it with a computer again, to look at the maximal monoids in the five-element case. I think this is what they are. There's a number of them. One of them is actually off the page, so S5 is off the page. Anyway, the point is that the computer couldn't even do basic computation because the lattice was getting too big. And so this is the limitation of the classification by lattice. I mean, of course, the classification by lattice is doomed. Even though each of the lattices is finite, we can't just keep going and checking an infinite number of domain sizes. For 2 was done by hand. For 3, in fact, was done by hand. We just got the computer to draw the lattice. We didn't need to draw the lattice to verify the complexity. And in the case of 5, so in the case of 4, we were able to verify by computer. We couldn't draw the lattice. The lattice is too big. 5, we couldn't even try to do a verification. And so we need to move away from the lattice. We need to move away from a direct search on the lattice. Of course, we're not, in fact, going to abandon the algebraic method at all. And this is the theorem. So, I mean, it's exactly what we've seen. It's what we were hoping to prove, and you can prove it. And so while it was solved for these smaller domains directly by looking at the lattice, now we have a stronger method to solve it for larger domains in generality. And the previous ingredients were Galois correspondence and tractability via relativization of quantifiers. And the new ingredients, the crucial ingredient, is a notion of core. And then a normal form for the monoid associated with the core of the structure. And then generic hardness proofs. And in fact, the point of the generic hardness proofs is the following, that the hardness proofs that we already have for domain 4, 3, and 2 essentially are okay for all other domains. There is a canonical generalization of that exotic monoid in the four-element case that covers all of the remaining possibilities. So in some sense, the richness of this problem is already exhibited on domain 4 and doesn't manifest in any greater extension of that on higher domains. The contentious issue of the core. Now, we've had many different definitions of cores. that should of course be all of whose endomorphisms are embeddings. But for the case of the finite, we tolerate this version. So it's well known that the core is unique and sits as a unit, as a substructure in a finite object. But another way to define the core is as a minimal subset such that you can relativize the existential quantifiers to that subset. And it's an obvious characterization. It's clear this is a sensible way to define a core, but we don't normally think of the core in this logical sense. And we ask the question, does there exist a core-like notion for positive equality-free logic? And the answer is yes. We need two relativizing sets, U for universal, X for existential. Again, this is not something that we can take for granted. There doesn't appear to be a nice notion of core for QCSP, or at least there might be, but it doesn't have the same properties as the core for CSP and the core for this. It doesn't have this uniqueness property. It doesn't sit as an induced substructure. That's the property. It can't have both of those properties. Whereas for CSP and for this, we have both of those properties. And moreover, okay, so this is not something that's too difficult to see. When we have a situation where we have a shop that's a sheave, we have a sheave that maps this relativizing set U to the entire domain, and where the inverse of X is the entire domain, then in fact we can do this thing and relativize in any sentence all the universal quantifiers to U and all the existential quantifiers to X. We can do that simultaneously. And so then what we can in fact do is minimize X and minimize U independently, and then assert that they can exist together, and then maximize their intersection. And then we obtain something that we call a reduced monoid. So some people would say, okay, this is a bit unnatural. Minimize X, minimize U, maximize their intersection. Why not minimize X union U? In fact, it's the same thing. It turns out to be the same thing. So we take one of the two definitions and we choose this one. And so the substructure of D induced by U union X when you do this satisfies the same positive equality free sentences. That's obviously true by this statement here. And we can call it the core, a UX core. And it's unique outside isomorphism, so the terminology makes sense. And here's an example. So this is something that appeared as a maximal monoid in my slide on the five-element case. And it's an example of something in the five-element case that doesn't obviously look like something in the four-element case. You know, we saw examples where I saw we were looking at S2, and it was obviously S2 when you saw that 0 and 1 were the same element, or here 1 and 2 are the same element. That's not the case with this. There's no immediate way to see that this is just something from the four-element case in disguise. But what we can find out is that we can take the set U to be 1 and 3. The union of the blue things there is the whole domain. And we can take X to be 0 and 4 because the inverse of 0 and 4 covers the whole domain. And so in fact, we can restrict the structure and thus the monoid to those cases. We can in fact wipe out the entry for 2. And now we get something in the four-element case that we already recognize. And this is the point. So already we're seeing these ways to reduce the complexity, reduce the complexity of classification, because we reduce monoids to something that is essentially the core of the monoid, which corresponds to the core of the structure as well, the structure of which that would be the monoid of sheaves. And so we have the tractable cases. So the thing about this table is, in fact, these things are if and only ifs. The log space case happens if and only if we have both an A shop and an E shop, if and only if the U X core is of size 1 in each of the elements, and if and only if we have quantifier relativization. So if we have quantifier relativization, then we have that. The same here. If we have quantifier relativization, then we have that. If we have quantifier relativization, then we have that. If we don't have quantifier relativization, if you can give an instance where the where you can't substitute via quantifier resolution relativization, then you're not in these cases. So this is actually a logical characterization, a combinatorial characterization, an algebraic characterization, and a complexity characterization, and they are all if and only yes. And the point is, we all already knew the easy cases, the point is to prove the hard cases. Just because you can't use quantifier relativization, quantifier elimination or quantifier relativization, doesn't necessarily mean it should be p-space hard. It's, yes?
Did I hear this too? You are claiming that these are economies to improve NP is not equal to current P?
No, they're if and only if in, yeah, okay, that you're right. So, okay, let's forget about the complexity assumption and say if and only if here. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. I saved my proof for NP is different from co-NP to another day. And so the remaining case is when we have both these sets greater than or equal to 2. And here is, I don't always enjoy these drawings, but this is why I gave the drawing of a shop as a digraph. This is a case where we have a shop as a digraph. When we have the two sets greater than or equal to 2, we have always in the monoid, it's a reduced monoid, so the monoid is equal to X union U. We have a particular shop, we prove the existence of a particular shop where everything is mapped to itself, like that, and that the only other things we can have are some arrows from U to X, from U not X into X not U. We can have that, some of them, in any arrangement. And in fact, moreover, all shops within that monoid look a bit like that. They can be permutations within U not X, they can be permutations within X not U, and they can be permutations in U intersect X. And apart from that, they can just have some arrows from U not X to X not U. And this is the crucial observation, because all the shops in the reduced monoid are of this form, we're able to derive results about the shape of structures that we can use to witness the hardness of these problems. And so when we have that both U and X have size at least 2, we can consider three cases. Rather embarrassingly, the top case was omitted in our Licks paper. But it's actually an easy case. It's necessarily we have permutations, and we know from previous results that this case is p-space complete. We can take the k-clique, where k is the size of the domain, and that will witness the hardness. So then we have, that's when u and x coincide. Remember, they're both of size greater than or equal to 2. This case is kind of interesting when we have that their intersection is non-zero. So that was actually what was drawn on the previous slide. And what we can do in this case is you essentially collapse all of those things to a single element, and then collapse all of these things to a single element. And then you get something that's essentially a bit like K2. One side's green, one side's blue. And then that becomes hard by essentially the cases that we saw already in the Boolean lattice. And then the third case is in fact the interesting one, and it's not possible to exhibit a really simple proof. What we do is we complete the monoid by adding everything, and then we prove that that's hard. So the point is, you can always, if you have a monoid, you can always add stuff to it, and if you can prove the thing with stuff added to it is hard, then it implies the same thing backwards. The same with polymorphisms, of course. If you can add polymorphisms and it still remains hard, then once you take away polymorphisms, it remains hard. But because of the highly regular structure of this completed monoid in this form with permutations and permutations and permutations, well, they're equal to just two sets of permutations. We can in fact build a structure with lots and lots of automorphisms that gives a generic hard proof that's quite similar to the four-element case. Perhaps I just draw it because it's very easy. Essentially, the four-element case is hard because of this structure. So the hardness proofs are all either cliques, or, well, the K2 is a clique, or they're structures that look a little bit like that. They're that with lots and lots of automorphisms added on expanding signatures. And so with this method, I've only given in the talk the situation for p-space hardness. Then there, of course, are the other parts of the monoid, the maximal cases for NP hardness and for co-NP hardness, but they're in fact a lot easier. There is never any anything particularly difficult there. I think you have, you always have something like this. So that's a canonical example of an NP complete problem. We all have things that look a bit like that. And so this is the slide that gives the tetracotomy, and their equivalences hold modulo the complexity theoretic assumptions. And in fact, the meta problem is also decidable. It's NP, not quite NP complete. It's not a decision problem. The meta problem would take a structure, and it answers with one of four things. So it's not a decision problem. It's NP hard, and in fact, even for a fixed finite signature. But it's also essentially in NP, because to determine, differentiate between any partition of these four and its negation is in NP. So the reason I can't quite call it NP complete is because it's not a decision problem, but it's NP hard, and it's essentially in NP. And so in conclusion, this is the slide that my co-author came up with. We solved this weird problem. Great work going on in CSPs, and maybe soon we can have a breakthrough there. QCSP still seems horrible. I mean, it's very, very difficult to work in. This is not having notions of cause, not knowing, and actually there are not many great results known for QCSP at all. But I think that's the last slide. Yes, that's it. Thank you.